don't work. But it does say, I don't know. Stop recording, pause recording. Okay, so it does this time reflect that it's gone. We have these issues when these bots join, they mess up Zoom's UI on like when the recording stops or starts. So I think that's what happened this time. All right, everyone. Welcome to Office Hours. 1 second, let me get my show notes up. Hey, everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, where we discuss latest AWS news, DevOps trends, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's July 23rd, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse sells AWS reference architectures. They get you production ready in just 2 weeks. So if you're curious to learn more about that, go to cloudposse.com and we talk a lot about it there. So how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format is very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools like Atmos or any of our modules, this is a great place to ask. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live. So you can join us live by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours, where if you register, you'll get an invitation to your inbox. So I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, share it with your team. That's how we spread the word and get and grow our community. So with that said, let's see what caught my attention this week here. All right. First, Google has introduced a new program called OSS Rebuild. And they are trying to, I guess, improve, the supply chain integrity of certain key open source projects. And they I haven't gotten a chance to read too much into the announcement yet. The other one was something interesting brought to our attention. I think I forget which channel it was in SuiteOps, but if you don't know, VMware acquired Bitnami, and Bitnami has become kind of like their package registry has become part of Tanzu. And like what you've seen in a lot of like enterprise-y commercial open source, as a way of reclaiming some of the value, they are I think going to discontinue releasing tagged versions of images. This is so that if you want to have a stable usage of your Helm charts managed by Bitnami, you have to pay for a license, and then you get access to a private registry of Docker images tagged with the versions. So what will be available are only the basically the bleeding edge latest tags for all those Docker images. It sucks, but on the other hand, as an open source company, I empathize with wanting to do some changes like that. We saw this happen with CentOS and CentOS Stream. I believe CentOS Stream is doing something similar, so they aren't doing like the they aren't matching Red Hat Enterprise releases anymore like they used to, and it's just like a bleeding edge thing. And I think it's a fair balance because on the one hand, it serves developers who tend to want to be running on the bleeding edge anyways. And if your business depending on it, I think it makes sense that you probably should have some sort of a support relationship with the company. So yeah, that's my two cents. I think Gravitational Teleport might be doing something similar with their open source. Any other examples of this or any other insights from this announcement? I think we used to use a lot of Bitnami charts back in the day, but these days I don't know how much we use maybe like an Nginx chart here or there. So impact for us is relatively minor, and this effect is happening in August, at the end of August. All right. Next announcement. Rishav, I saw your post here. This is June. Okay, so this is a re relatively recent post. I thought you had already published this, but maybe the update here is on adopting merge queues, Rishab.
That's pretty much it. Yeah, we've been using
Cool.
merge queues for a wee while now, but we never really got around to getting it production ready or in a way that's public
Yeah.
facing. Finally managed to get it into a wee blog post.
Very cool. So yeah, why don't you lay down the case of settle this argument once and for all. Merge before or apply after merge or before merge?
And I think it should probably be worth saying right off the bat, like of the two methods, I think people are mostly agreed that apply after merge is usually a pretty good approach. There are some compromises you have to make, but at least your main branch roughly resembles truth as close as possible, unless something goes wrong. The only op other option, if you apply before merge, which is usually what Atlantis does, that kind of is a given that your main branch is almost never reality because it's one of the PR branches, which is either
Yeah.
applied and it's like planned. And not to mention, if you apply before merge, now you have to think about PR logs. One of your PR is going to be the lead, it's the one that holds the state. The rest of your PRs, you
Yeah.
can't do anything. And that kind of sucks
And
when
drift detection is impossible then too,
that's
really.
another one as well. And that's a little bit kind of frustrating. Even if it's a small team, you're like stuck not being able to do anything. And merge queues, for what it's worth, this is something that GitHub came up with in 2023, and it was very clearly for software engineers to move quickly, to speed up their ex developer experience and velocity. So instead of having to wait for merging one thing, updating your branch, merging another thing, this is a way to merge multiple PRs at the same time. And assuming they pass status checks, like your unit tests or CI tests, they will get merged in turn. You're not held back or anything like that. That's what I wanted to try with Terraform. The only issue is Terraform is a stateful thing. So between plan and apply, you need some way of maintaining your state. And for what it's worth, this is what this blog post dives into, is by adopting merge queues and a pretty reusable GitHub Action workflow, which is linked somewhere down below, you kind of get the best of both worlds, where if you click merge, it will run and apply just like it's running on the main branch. If it succeeds, brilliant, PR is merged, you have applied, and it's all good. If it fails for any reason, for example, your subnet is out of capacity or your S3 bucket naming convention isn't compatible, if that sort of thing happens, it will remain open as a PR, just like it would happen on Atlantis or something like that. So you're very easily able to add another fix, a patch in the same PR, so you don't even lose context, which is what you would usually have to do by opening up a new PR and adding fixes rapidly. And that's what kind of
Did
really
you
popped
do anything post like if it fails, did you take any automatic remediations at
up.
that
Oh, I'm
time?
so glad you asked. Yeah, if you scroll down to like I think like case three on your page, that's exactly one of the things is this opens up a whole new thing of what do you do if something breaks for for any reason. In our case, we have yeah, there we go. I think if you go just up a wee little bit. There we go. So we have a rollback instead. So what it does there is, since merge queues will mean your main branch is always a deployable state, otherwise it won't merge. That means it's relatively safe that if your apply fails for any reason, just pull down the main branch and apply it auto approve. No need to get approval for that. No need to wait. Just auto approve main. And the only edge case we've worked out internally and chatting about it with the OpenTofu Slack is if you were to add a new provider, for example, and that failed, you can't go back to main since any resources you provisioned with the new provider, that provider doesn't exist in your main branch. Pretty super niche, and you're probably not adding providers every day in every PR. And even if you are, there's a chances that you do the provider first and then the resources come in a second PR. You do it like step by step. In any case, that was one of the things we loved is that opened it up for our case of we can roll back to main whenever. We could also do other things. We could notify Slack. We could email someone. We could let anyone know and do any kind of automation because it's all GitHub. That's it. There's nothing crazy, just GitHub Actions.
Yeah, I really like it. I think it's an elegant solution, the best of both worlds.
As good
So
as we
that's
can get.
cool.
It is annoying that it is GitHub centric, unfortunately, so I can't use the same exact thing in GitLab, for example. And a lot of folks have said, can we have something similar there? For what it's worth, GitLab has a really nice CI built in. It just doesn't have the most open marketplace, which is what GitHub focuses on.
Yeah. Does GitLab have a merge queue alternative?
They do, yeah.
GitLab?
They call it a merge train, which is apparently what GitHub used to call it initially. They used to call their thing merge train as well, and then They renamed it to Merge Queue. GitLab is stuck with Merge Train. And it's the same concept, same thing there as well.
Emerge train. Ah, yeah, I think I do recall seeing that. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Well, thanks for writing that up. That's really interesting. I'm excited to check that out. One of the well, I'm gonna bring that up at on another office hours call. We one of the cool things we implement one of the cool things we implemented in Atmos was a plan diff, which can take a look at two different plans and tell you if there's a difference. And that's interesting because that's a safe that's kind of a safer way to do an auto apply. If you do a plan diff, and they might not be exactly the same from a data structure perspective, but if, as an effective diff of like what is changing, it's the same, then it's cool because then you can have confidence that what you're auto applying is exactly what you were thought you were doing in the previous run. But that means that you have to have a record of the original plan.
Genuinely, genuinely so glad you brought that up because that was when I posted this on the SweetOps Slack. Lauren Gordon, you might be familiar, is one of the persons who responded. And they came up with this exact same question of, hey, quite often when I merge a PR, it sucks that I then have to wait for it to replan and then apply it again because you can't just add it in a queue. You can't just blindly auto-approve it because that doesn't really exist. And with this approach and this workflow we actually have a little plan diff checker built in. So, in the event you want to merge three different PRs, because quite often your Terraform doesn't always overlap. Sometimes you have an update here, sometimes you want to add there. And in those cases, there's no point they have to wait for one another to finish. So, if you were to add both to the merge queue, since when a plan is run, it saves the plan as an artifact in GitHub Actions and it's encrypted, so no one can just open up the plan and read off your secrets. Since the plan is saved as an artifact, it actually does a quick check of, oh, looks like we're in a merge queue. Let me check if the current plan, or let me check that the plan we have stored is the same as one we generate just now. And if there is no diff, it uses the new plan, because that way you avoid stale applies. If there is any diff at all, any issues, it just uses the old plan, says, hey, you have a stale
How
plan,
did
you
you
need to review.
do this? How did you do the diff implementation?
Sure. So for the old plan, that's easy peasy. You just have the plan in your workflow artifact. You retrieve that. For the new plan, it does the same thing as before. It runs a new plan. For the diff bit, we get a JSON of both of those plans and we compare the. We just kind of literally walk through the tree in JSON after
So you
sorting
did
it.
write a utility for that.
That's
You
exactly it. And the
so
whole.
that's the same thing we did.
That's exactly it. And for what it's worth, I did get a few things wrong initially. I thought, yeah, I'm sure it's going to be sorted all the time. It turns out they are not sorted all the time. You have to do that yourself.
Data structures in Go, like maps, are by default not sorted and are random every execution. So yeah. All right.
But I'm at least glad that it is consistent because that's all you need. As long as it's the same output every time, it's deterministic, that's a-okay.
Very cool. Well, pushing the envelope as always, Rochelle. So
Thank
very
you. I
cool.
appreciate it.
All right, let's see here. So there was a post trending on Hacker News today. If you're on GitHub Actions and using like your own self-hosted runners, one of the really annoying things is the Microsoft cache is very slow from AWS, especially like when it's supposed to be a cache. What these companies are doing that offer like managed solutions for GitHub Action Runners is a way of bypassing the Microsoft cache for artifacts. That has two benefits. One, number one thing being performance, the second one being cost. It gets pretty expensive using the GitHub Actions cache. So this here is one of Blacksmith is like a run like so we're big fans. We always talk about runson.com, which is a nice solution that runs on AWS. You just do a donation sponsorship, and then you can use this CloudFormation template. Or there are a bunch of these companies now. Blacksmith is another one, and they've just implemented the same kind of functionality. So Runzon calls it Magic Cache. I don't know what they're calling it here for Blacksmith, but they go through kind of ha how they arrived at the solution, why it works the way it does. But it also brought up That there is, if you are like running your own system, or maybe you're using Actions Runner Control or some other solution, you want to do the same thing. There is actually a self-hostable version of this that somebody else has written called the GitHub Actions Cache Server, and then using some IP table rewrites and that kind of thing, you get your requests to go through this instead, and then you can point those at, I believe, S3 or a self-hosted option. So if you haven't seen just how radically fast it is to use your own cache versus GitHub, you'll be blown away. All right, next. So we released another Cloud Posse grade Terraform module. This is for managing GitHub repositories. There are other modules out there, but if you're not familiar with Cloud Posse, we manage a internally consistent ecosystem of hundreds of Terraform modules. All of them come with automated tests. We gravitate towards TerraTest. Still, so we have a comprehensive test suite here, along with this, implementing all the functionality. So this takes, I don't know, roughly 4 or 5 different resources for managing GitHub repositories, including action environments, issues, the repository, webhooks, repository, app installations, basically every single thing you can do, and managing that with Terraform. So where this is going is, as you know, we have a tool called Atmos. So we have Atmos. It's a really elegant framework for how you manage your Terraform infrastructure at scale. It has the concept of components. Components are these reusable pieces. So we have a PR open for the component for this as well. That hasn't merged yet. I believe it'll be merged today. And that allows you now to manage your infrastructure with Atmos, with stack configurations, using all the dry configuration abilities of, let me go to the branch of Atmos. I think we have an example here. Has it been updated? Nope, the example hasn't been updated yet. So when that goes live, I'll bring it up on office hours again. But this is going to be really cool because with Atmos, you can now manage like your AWS account factory together with, yeah, I mean, well, manage with Terraform, so not Control Tower or any of that crap. But using Terraform, and then to manage that, and then you can have this component create a repository that can host the infrastructure. Maybe you create a new OU for some team with dev staging and prod accounts, then you can automatically create the infrastructure repository for that team, and then you can automatically set up the GitHub OADC, and you can do all of this with Atmos and the modules that we are making available in the components. One of the opinionated things that we've done in this implementation for managing the GitHub repositories is that you should not manage more than one repository per instance of the module, and the way we will implement the component is it'll work the same. So you create one instance of the module for each repository you manage. That way, you keep your blast radius small, reduce the GitHub API rate limit issues, and if anything goes wrong, managing one repository doesn't affect all your ability to manage your GitHub organization as a whole. So, yeah, anybody using the Terraform providers for managing GitHub today? How's that working out for you? Any battle scars you care to share?
I previously managed GitHub with Terraform, but the provider was horribly unstable until about a year ago. And GitHub, I'll be blunt. I've lost all respect for GitHub. Their enterprise support is really bad. And they just kind of said, too bad. In the last year, last year that's improved. I'm not sure if it was from GitHub themselves or from the community, but it has become more stable. So my team was looking at using Terraform again to manage some of our repo configurations.
Exactly. And that is what the story was. Until recently, the provider wasn't stable and you couldn't do a lot of the things with it. I believe that's what's changed now. And for what it's worth, all of our tests are passing. So I assume it's working well.
Now, are you
Well,
testing strictly on GitHub Cloud or also GitHub Enterprise?
no, not we are using GitHub Enterprise, but cloud, enterprise cloud.
Okay.
And we are managing repository rule sets with it, which is a GitHub Enterprise feature.
Yeah, that was the main thing, was to get the repositories to meet our standards consistently when you have dozens and dozens and dozens of repositories. That was our main use
Yeah.
case.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially on the enterprise side, I think I was just looking at the GitHub changelog blog the other day, and they've been rolling out new features around CodeQL, like setting up advanced security rules and such for enabling, disabling CodeQL across your enterprise repositories. It seems like that's a whole huge bunch of options. All of that's in this module?
Well, it sounds like what you are talking about would be an organizational setting. This is managing a repository, not managing the organization.
Gotcha, I'm
And
with you.
the API and hence the provider for managing the organization is a lot more limited. And that's why, so we're doing this as part of an implementation with a client, and we decided that it wasn't worth pursuing the organization at this time due to how limited it was. So you'd still have to do so much click ops to, and then you run into this thing where you don't know where something was managed. So we decided, okay, repositories managed fully with Terraform, organizations still managed with conventional click ops.
Gotcha.
So,
All right.
about
Yep.
that, I've tried this approach before. It ended up kind of being a blocker because teams would have to do a PR before they can start any work, even if it's exploratory. How do you balance that?
You have two options, really. And first is using GitHub Enterprise and multiple organizations. So I would advise having a separate GitHub organization for your exploratory work, where you don't have all the rules and controls. But then again, you also don't have access to the internal systems. But that's by design. Like either you follow the controls, you gain access to the systems, you can have the protections, or you don't gain access to any of those systems because you don't have the controls, and then you can work freely. So I don't think there's a happy medium between those two.
That makes sense.
But yeah, but it's not always practical, right? You can have that test organization, but if the Skunk Work project you're trying to do needs access to the other systems, then you'll be limited. But yeah, I think it's a necessary trade-off in any kind of regulated space. All right, next. So this just caught my attention for two reasons. One is so in Go, you can cross-compile for multiple architectures. That's how most people do their Windows builds. So I think the slowness that, well, which is the next thing I'm going to get to, isn't maybe something that everyone experiences building for Windows. But for Atmos, one of the things we wanted to do was ensure that not while we could cross-compile for Windows, we also wanted to make sure just the build process itself and the developer experience worked for Windows. So we actually run in a matrix, and we actually build Atmos for Windows on Windows, so it works that way. But one of the things that is remarkable is it's easily like 10 times slower than doing Go builds for Mac or Linux. Like it'll finish in like 1 or 2 minutes or something on Mac or Linux, and then 10 minutes later it's crawling through and wrapping up with building Windows. So I was curious, A, did anyone know that Microsoft had their own separate build of Go? B, is that for some reason faster? And C, I wonder if the reason why they're doing this is because it's so freaking slow. And if no more insights, that's cool too. Let's see, moving on. So we are not experts at Databricks, but we see all it's coming up like constantly. Our customers are using Databricks. So like, yeah, that business is on fire. Like every enterprise seems to be using Databricks. And I just came across this today, so I haven't looked into it, but it is by Databricks. It has lots of examples for all the different types of things. So if your organization is using Databricks, this is maybe a great resource for you to check out for examples. The resource, we scoped out at one point building some of the modules for Databricks, and then I realized just how crazy many resources there are for that platform. And prompts them to having proper examples for me. And then just a shout out. This is not new news. This came out in April, but it was new to me, or at least I forgot. But at KubeCon, it was discussed. Fidelity came out as having made the switch over to OpenTofu. So that's really cool. A large financial institution backing, or showing faith or confidence in the project. So if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for you. All right.
It does help that at least at this stage of time, it's near enough identical. There is so little to change, unless you're using things like ephemeral values and the latest features.
Bleeding edge things. Yeah. So long as you stay off the bleeding edge, which is called that for a reason, you'll have pretty good parity. And the thing for the major things that do come out for BSL license Terraform, they will probably get adopted at some point in OpenTofu if there's enough community interest in it. Like ephemeral values. I believe there's a RFC for that. It hasn't been started yet, but gathering interest.
Definitely, yeah. I was just in their stand-up the other day, and yeah, they mentioned I think they're 1.11. The big two features is ephemeral values to get
Oh, really?
parity with
Okay.
Terraform, and they were coming up with another feature which isn't quite as well advertised, but it seems huge. It's an if condition, so no longer are we doing count equals something or another like ternary. They're finally just doing, hey, if you want an if condition for a single instance, you can do that now, probably. So.
Yeah, we'll have an else.
Oh no, oh no. It's too much to ask for in one go, surely not.
Easy, easy, take it easy. And in a similar way, just seeing evidence of OpenTofu usage out in the wild. So Google Cloud Platform is a GitHub organization officially managed by Google on how to use Terraform with Google Cloud GCP. And an example of a using the .tofu file, which is a way of overriding things when you're running tofu. So here they show the versions of providers to use, for example, when using OpenTofu. And that is also evidence that it's stable with tofu, presumably. Google is publishing this. All right. Well, that's all I got. Let's see the chat. If anything else caught you guys' attention here. Oh, Miguel, yeah, we talked about the Bitnami rug pull, if you want to call it that. I mean, Bitnami was acquired by VMware, and they've gone full enterprise, so could have been worse. Well, in VMware, they were bought by Broadcom, right? So that, I guess, that explains a lot.
Weren't they selling the higher grade of that as the Tanzu, whatever? Like you could go.
Exactly.
Are they still doing?
Yeah, exactly. So I believe Bitnami is part of the Tanzu framework that VMware has. And that's why this is happening, right? So they're pulling back certain things that were available previously in open source. So it's not doing a license change, it's not doing any of that stuff, but it is, making it a little bit less convenient to use their charts, of course, because you'd have to bring your own Docker images. Kind of mitigate, kind of defeat some of the purpose of why you would use Bitnami in the first place, but
Yeah, I looked at the Tanzu versions of them before just because of the images, not the Helm charts, for because they had FIPS and a few other security controls on them, but they did a really bad job on their website of like how I even would buy it. So it was like not clear on how I even acquired that part of the thing.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if that's coming along with this as a overhaul of that, but I do recall seeing the same thing, like it not being obvious for how to pay for it or buy it or things like that. And if you have to buy the whole platform, or can you just license access to the charts? Not sure. Let's see what else. Pulled up too far. GitLab provider for such Amazon used in the past to manage creation process. This is fun. Amazon Q now helpful. Oh, let's see what this is about. Isaac, what was the Amazon Q news?
So someone managed to get a PR in that is just prompt injection to wipe out your computer, and people are not happy around about how Amazon is handling the issue.
Interesting. I just the thing, feel like deja vu. I was just reading another article where something very similar happened. It deleted the person's whole GitHub repository or GitHub history or
That
GitHub
was
history.
someone who
Got
was
it.
in the
Got their
Replit,
database.
yeah, the
That's
Replit
it.
AI agent.
That was it. It's conspiring. AI is collectively conspiring against us. So yeah, what what's the TLDR here? How has the issue been handled? What is the
There was no CVE or anything like that. They just wiped out traces of that commit existing another thing.
Oh, wait, okay, so we take a step back, start over. Wait, so there was a malicious commit that entered into what in particular?
The Q agent.
Into the Q agent, and that was detected, and no CVE or nothing was basically issued about it, and the commit just disappeared, and they're moving on.
That's what the article claims.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting if true. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sure that's not gonna just go unnoticed if that was true. So let's see. Was this on Hacker News or where did you see this?
No, last week in AWS.
Okay. That's a newsletter, right?
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
On a slight tangent, the CVE, that's for like common vulnerabilities, right? Isn't that a US company?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was a US organization or nonprofit, right? That was that whole brouhaha when the funding was supposedly getting cut to it, and then
It. I was just gonna say, I heard a lot about they were getting defunded and all that. Did anything come of it, or is it just back to as it was?
yeah, almost immediately a consortium of companies or security related companies came together to
Right.
refund it and make it.
Right.
But I believe it also prompted Europe to do something, or
Ooh.
a
Which is more
European.
appro which is more appropriate, right? Do you want one nation's government controlling vulnerabilities? Not really.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any harm in having, yeah, right. It keeps things honest by having more than one system. So, but
Yeah, but
at this
the
point,
U.S. government only maintains what they call their KEV list, which is their certain KEV. It's known exploitable vulnerabilities, which is ones that are somewhere in the federal government they've actually seen it exploited, and so they put on the
oh,
spec
interesting.
that's higher than critical. It's KEV is a special marker from CISA.gov has a list of them.
That's interesting.
Does remind me, I think there was probably a joke about if you're ever working with Terraform state files, have a region in US and another in Frankfurt, just in case of political conflicts. You have options.
Yeah. What was that though? There was something, I feel like we talked about it on office hours, AWS new administrative zone or something.
That's yeah, the EU sovereign zone.
Sovereign, yeah.
Being rolled out this year, or later this year, fully. They're looking for vendors and whatnot to go onto it. So it'll be similar to GovCloud or AWS China, in that it will be, controlled and isolated in certain ways, certain services.
Oh, got it. Yeah,
Or
yeah, yeah.
call it sovereign cloud, but it's basically just another GovCloud, but for that particular region.
That's helpful. So GovCloud is like a partition, so Sovereign Cloud would be a separate partition of
Yeah, it's its own
AWS.
partition, so you can't communicate to
Yeah.
other like network. You can do what you want, but like your I if you have an IM to AWS, you can talk to any other thing in the normal what they call standard AWS partition. So you could be IAM and switch to a profile in Frankfurt, anywhere else. Roles can talk to each other across the regions, all that type of stuff. Once you're in a partition, there's literally they they're it's like at that point, Azure talking to GCP, they're completely separate, other than the fact that yeah, you could talk to the network, but you can't
Yeah.
talk to the network. So they're completely isolated. Sometimes they're actually still in the same physical data center, but just on different like halls of the data center or something.
Yeah.
They're physically, from a network standpoint at least, separated. The people that can go and work on them, I don't know what the sovereign rules are, but like the GovCloud rules would be they have to be U.S. citizens that can physically even touch the machines and a bunch of other stuff like that.
And was this created to fill the same need as GovCloud is to the US and government
For EU.
agencies?
Yes, for EU, yeah.
Okay.
Or
For the EU.
customers. You
Okay.
don't, anybody can use, any US company can use GovCloud, so you might use it if you just want
Yeah.
that further control.
Yeah.
But yeah, or if you want certain levels of compliance like FedRAMP High, you have to go and use GovCloud. So EU sovereign and same goals. The controls and whatnot are not as strict. This is my space. The controls are not as strict as FedRAMP. And the US federal rules, but it's similar goals.
And with this, or does, do you know if GCP or Azure offer the same thing as Sovereign Cloud for EU?
I forgot if they have isolated gov zones or not. GCP takes a slightly different approach. They have less of the sharing. I haven't looked to see what they have in a while. Most likely they do. Azure is normally ahead on some of these things, surprisingly.
Very interesting. All right, let's see here. So, do you or anyone else use patched hardened container vendors such as Tanzu, ChainGuard, RapidFor,
Yeah, I was gonna.
ChainGuard? Yeah, ChainGuard seems to be. I mean, I see it popping up all the time. All of a sudden, for some reason, in the past month on my LinkedIn, but I haven't been paying attention to it. So yeah, our customers are not predominantly using that.
Excuse me, community. That means they don't have anybody holding them accountable for vulnerabilities because most of the community images are pretty awful when it comes to vulnerabilities. Like I'm finding ones that like I don't know, really common ones, Fluent Operator, and it hasn't had a it's had a critical CV in it for like 4 months with no release. So that's why they're taking off. So
Yeah, it's an interesting area. I mean, the depth that one can go to try, like the way these things are written and the amount of software, there. I think, yeah, I don't know how it's sustainable to stay current with everything in the way something like ChainGuard would afford you, but. So, what do you guys use? Or you don't have to disclose, but which way are you leaning?
I know about a fair amount about ChainGuard and RapidFor work. So I've talked to both of those. RapidFor's another one. They originally did work for the federal government first. They contracted for years with them privately and then went to be public for the last 2 years. But yeah, they have to have pretty, they would do what you would do internally anyway, is you'd have to build a lot of stuff from scratch and not use the community image. Like for a long time, there were a lot of Go, especially since it's not shared library. Every time there's a release, you can't just update the OS, you have to do a whole new build, I was building my own Helm, I was building my own Prometheus, I was building pretty much everything from scratch. because the community was so slow to patch vulnerabilities that we had to build all of our stuff from scratch. So vendors like Vanguard, RapidForge, they have an appeal because they're going to do that.